So for those of you who just came here, saw the based on the title, you can be rest assured, the contents haven't changed that much. So that's okay. And this is work in progress by myself and Jan-Pieter van der Schaar. So let's get started. I just want to start with the main message I would like to bring across in this very short period of time. First of all, whenever you modify the initial state, you'll find that one contribution that always returns is the unfolded shape on Gaussian entities. This is actually shown by Chen et al. And Bowman and Tully. But if you work in the language of boundary effect field theory, you'll get extra contributions. And these should be related to the first contribution. This is still the exact way how this is related. We're still working on that. Then, to measure this first contribution, the unfolded shape, we actually need a template to use this as a match filter for the CMB. And no such template existed. And here we try to propose such a template. And hopefully, we can measure this non-Gaussian entity using this template to constrain the initial state. So these are sort of the main messages I would like to bring across. So very briefly, the outline of this talk, I'll introduce why we use the Bayes spectrum to measure non-Gaussian entities very briefly. I'll tell something about boundary effect field theory and the contributions coming from boundary effect field theory in the form of non-Gaussian entities. Then I'll talk about non-Gaussian shape, particularly unfolded shape. And I'll wrap up with conclusions, and hopefully there will be time for some questions. So what we usually look at is the two-point function. This is your CMB map, very familiar to most of you. And we measure the temperature of the two points in the sky, and we can see that's going to be spherically transformed to ALMs. We can correlate these ALMs and average over M because of isotropy. And this gives our power spectrum. And we can do a similar thing for three points in the sky. And the same approach gives us the Bi spectrum. So why is the Bi spectrum interesting? Well, it has more degrees of freedom. Obviously, it has depends on 3L. And it measures Gaussian entities. It's basically the first statistics you can use to measure deviation from Gaussianity. And we all believe, or basically, I think most of us believe, that the fluctuations in the CMB are actually a relic of quantum fluctuations, which are blown up by inflation. And as we have seen throughout this conference, there's many different models of inflation. And you can use the Bayes spectrum, because it has more degrees of freedom, to exclude one model over another. At least that's your goal. And this is because you'll find that different models will end up with differently shaped Gaussian entities. So with these different shapes, you might, if you can measure these, we hope that we can find the signature of fundamental physics. But here we won't discuss a different model of inflation. Instead, we will modify the initial state and see what kind of non-Gaussian entities you can get from that. So basically, we know that if we go to large numeric scales, at one point our view of the standard model breaks down, and we need to work in an effective language. And the same basically holds for initial state. So we're not sure, you know, where our assumption of a free vacuum breaks down, and we can just say, well, there's no modes in the CMB that non-free vacuum or non-Bunch-Davis state. So we just ignore it and we work in the Bunch-Davis state. But we think it's better to let the data decide and somehow parameterize our ignorance of scales, of large scales. So there's basically two possibilities. I will only talk about this one here, boundary effect field theory, in which you basically say that you know how things work beyond a time hypersurface, eta naught, and everything which is before eta naught can be parameterized using a boundary action. So in the language of actions, this becomes so the total action can be separated into two contributions, one coming from the bulk and one from the boundary. And the bulk action can be anything you want it to be, basically, as long as it, you know, suits your needs. Here, in this particular example, I gave a PBI action, but for the rest of this talk, we'll work in a single field slow roll, which is a particular example of PBI. And then the second contribution, which is a three-dimensional boundary action, we have a quadratic term with a opening kappa, and you can use this term to parameterize your initial state. And in fact, you can choose a particular kappa for which you return the bunch state. So this second term actually gives you deviations from bunch states. So if this term is zero, you're in a Gaussian initial state. But if you allow for higher order operators or beyond the quadratic, then your initial state will not be Gaussian. So basically, this is what I just said. The idea is as follows. If you have a non-zero delta S3, your initial state will not be Gaussian. And in fact, you can match this non-vanishing higher order operator term to delta kappa. So if you look at this form here, this would induce a kappa plus delta kappa in the quadratic term. And then you can also relate this kappa plus delta kappa to a Fourier transformation. So this is basically how it all comes together. So if we compute the three-point function, we can expect two contributions. The first contribution comes from the boundary. So that means because we have a delta S3 that might not be zero, and one from the bulk because we have a non-vanishing Fourier of parameter. So let us compute these things while we use the kind of familiar informalism, where we can set up an interaction Hamiltonian depending on the action you use for the bulk. And once again, it consists of two components, a bulk component and a boundary component. And these, and you should note this term here, actually, this is more important, where you have a delta function because you work on this time hypersurface, so that there's no integral over time. So this calculation here was actually done by Holman and Tolley, and here basically this is the result, single field slow roll, so there's no higher order or non-kinetical terms in your action. And what you see here that is a function of this k of j, this momentum k of j, which is the sum of all co-moving momenta, three co-moving momenta, minus two times one of these co-moving momenta. And you can actually plot this k dependence, and what you see here on the x-axis is kj, and you see that it peaks at kj equals pi over eta naught, so eta naught is zero. Once again, you're cut off. And since eta naught is very large, you'll find that kj is approximately zero, and this translates to the unfolded shape, since one of your co-moving momenta will be equal to the sum of the other two. So this is known as the unfolded shape. All right. And we have a second contribution. We'll just look at the marginal term here. So we only look at phi cubed. You can think of other terms in your delta S3, but we only look at phi cubed here. Oh, falls off somehow. Here. Anyways, there's just a bracket. It's not really a very big deal. This is here. This is the final result, basically. But we're trying to figure out what shape is exactly. What we can tell about this shape that for large k, this term vanishes, and we're working out the details of what happens in between. What we do know is that for supervising modes, so modes that were supervising before the cutoff, this thing reduces to the local shape. So this is a different shape from what we have found from the bulk. So next, I would like to talk about non-Gaussian shapes. I have no idea how familiar people are with non-Gaussian shapes. Basically, the thing is that we have so far, our WMAP team and also Craig Nelly and others, have tried to measure these two contributions to the three-point function, the local and the shape. And the reason why this is why these were measured is that until recently, these were basically only known shapes that came from models of inflation. So the infolded shape is actually quite unique for initial state modifications. And to measure these things, you need to find a factorizable template because to use as a match filter on your data. Because if you just want to, you cannot calculate the full bias spectrum because the number of computation skills is n to the power 5 halves, where n is the number of pixels of your CV map. And that actually, according to Komatsu, I think, takes like 100 years to compute. So if you don't want to wait for that, you have to make a match filter using this factorizable template. And this has been done for the local shape and for the equilateral shape, but not yet for the unfolded shape. So, or squashed shape, as we like to call it. So here we propose a factorizable template. The idea is as follows. Basically, what happens is that if you look at the usual contribution coming from slow roll, it
pointer?
No,
chalk?
Yeah, chalk. So, well, that everybody can see this. So, your usual contribution coming from the equilateral shape is proportional to something like this. So, this can be to some power, that doesn't really matter. And if you allow for a view of transformation, what happens is that one of the k's picks up a minus sign. So this actually turns to something like this. Obviously, it's always symmetrized in k's. So what you see here is this is why you have your infolded shape appearing, because this maximizes when one of the k's, or in this case, k1 equals k2 plus k3. So this is, you know, generically very different from the local and equilateral shape, where your shape maximizes at a point. Here it in fact maximizes on this line, and it's very hard to find a function that looks behaves like that, basically, that is factorized. So what we have done actually is try to take the already existing templates for the equilateral shape and replace one of the k's by minus k, and then, which is something we didn't know before, but we just tried it. We found that you should demand that if you take all k's equal, then it should be equivalent to 6 over k to the sixth. So it has sort of the same normalization as equilateral and local shaped non-Gaussian entities. And the result looks like this. So this is plotted as follows. You take out your k1 dependence, so you can put the, sort of the amplitude becomes how K1 behaves on the z-axis. And what you see here indeed is that it maximizes on this line within the triangle, and this is basically what you want for your unfolded shape. So I also have a nice fancy graphic here just to show you that when you apply this normalization of 6 over k to the 6th, then all your shape will smoothly transition in from one to the other. So here we start in a local shape, and we smoothly go to a folded, and then we end up in a collateral. Oh, please. Right, so we start out in local, then we go in folded, and we end up in a collateral. So that's sort of, I mean, it's just for a visual pleasure, I guess. So now we have three templates that correspond to three extreme triangles. as you've seen, you know, if you look at triangles, there's not really any other triangle possible than the local equilateral folded. And these are all measured by their associated FNL. And yeah, these have a k-dependence. And it seems that the last triangle, this one, is unique for initial state modification. And we think, or we claim basically, but we haven't proven yet, that equilateral and local shape alone do not fully parameterize a general three-point function, and using the unfolded shape might allow us to do this for sort of any three-point function. And I just want to show you like sort of an example of this. I just call this a flat shape, but it doesn't really, I have no idea how this looks actually for the triangle. But this was this appeared actually in an article a few weeks ago, though I do not remember the article. But I think it said, anyways, their k dependence was the following. It was 1 over k, 1 squared k, 2 squared k, 3 squared. And you can show that this can actually be written as a sum of the equilateral type plus the enfolded type. And the conclusion you can draw from this is that if the shape would dominate the data, then you'll find that the local non-Gaussian entity would be 0, while the equilateral and enfolded non-Gaussian entities would be approximately equal. So that does learn you something about other shapes as well, even though you haven't measured them. So let me wrap up with conclusions. We believe that the boundary effective field theory approach is a very elegant approach to take all contributions to initial state modification into account. As we've seen, that you get an extra contribution coming from the boundary, and these differ in shape, at least for supervised mode. So these will only be, can only be seen at very low L, maybe even depends a little bit on where you put your time hyperserves, and they will likely differ in amplitude. So we really have to, that's still a work in progress, we try to compare these contributions. And hopefully, that's actually the goal, if we are able to use this template on the data that we have set up, that we can constrain the initial state better than is now possible with using the power spectrum. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Correct me if I'm wrong. So you are considering some three dimensional initial surface and some interactions on this surface. But
yes.
It will switch off soon after that. And you will calculate the three-point function. Is that what you did?
I didn't follow the last part.
So the interaction, self-interaction is just on this initial surface. And
there's two contributions, right? There's interactions in the bulk. And there's interaction on the surface.
What is the theoretical motivation to consider such a setup?
Well, that's something that was brought by me by young Peter, who is more of an expert.
That's the serious angle.
He's
no. So the only reason to do that is to parameterize initial conditions. So the only thing that this is used for, this boundary action, is to ask if you vary the action, you have to take into account also the bearing. So now you no longer put the boundary variation to 0. You keep them free. So, and that means that actually by adding a boundary action, you're going to impose a set of initial conditions. So this boundary action is just there to impose a set of initial conditions. The advantage being that if you have a boundary action, you can try to look at quantum connections. That's basically the motivation.
My next question is that. Let me ask another question. Okay.
Well, if there are no other questions from other people.
Yes.
So doesn't this affect the two-point grid function as well?
The boundary, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. But this was done before, so.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is where you can get a bounds on initial state modifications using the power spectrum as well. That's what
I think it's still satisfying the two-point grid function. You may have observable amount of a three-point function, even if the satisfying the observation bound on the two-point function, you can have large enough.
Well, that really depends on a few assumptions. Yeah, so we're still trying to work that out. We hope, of course, that it will better constrain the initial state, but you know, we're never sure.
And so the two contributions you have from the boundary and then the bulk contribution.
Yeah.
Like typically, which do you have a sense of which one would be bigger?
Not yet. But we think it should be. Obviously, you know, it really depends on the size of lambda or theory coupling also. So it's and also
there must be some like field
upper bound.
Yeah.
Really
my initial field is actually that it will be small, but you have to be careful. You have to know how this lambda is by referred to affects the kappa. And
actually,
we're not sure, but
it is,
I think it's small.
Very good. Let's thank our speaker.